Well, we got up to slide 6 in this final chapter. And here we're looking at some Punnett squares for involving heritable genetic disorders. Now, not all genetic disorders are heritable, meaning that they are passed from parent to offspring. Like cancer, for instance, remember I said that cancer is a genetic disorder because it involves the genes. Mutation causes it. That's a change in the genes. But a heritable genetic disorder is caused by a version of allele that gets passed from parent to offspring. And no specific example is represented here, but not only is what's represented here a heritable genetic disorder, but it also is one that is caused, or that is, yeah, caused by a gene that is sex-linked. Remember, we talked about sex-linked genes before. And so, and this is a human example, so humans use XY system. That means that a female is going to have 2 alleles, and the male is going to have 1. What the symbols mean here, well, you have the male and female symbols, as you see, but as far as the boxes in the Punnett square are concerned, or for the parents individually, a white background means fully normal. That person does not have the disorder. Red, to the extent that that's red, the darker red here represents the fact that that individual has the disorder, whatever it is. And the lighter red is an individual who's a carrier, which means that individual doesn't actually have the disorder, is unaffected, but has one defective allele, and therefore can pass that defective allele on to offspring. So these aren't all the possibilities here. These are just 3 possibilities shown here, but it shows you how much it matters who mates with whom when it comes to these alleles that can cause disorders. Here you have a completely normal woman, X upper N, X upper N. N is just whatever the gene is, but the uppercase, the dominant one, is the normal one, and that's probably what they meant by N being normal. And the male is an affected individual. He has the disorder. If they are parents, if they mate, then however many offspring they have, the possibilities for them are shown in the Punnett square. So, first of all, notice that the left half, just like we were talking about for flies, are the daughters, the possible daughters, because they're XXs. Well, it says that all of the daughters, however many they have, if any, will not have the disorder, but they'll all be carriers because they'll all have one defective allele that they got from the father. So they can pass that on to their offspring if they have any. If they have any sons, though, since a male has to get his X from a mother and she was completely normal, all the males will be completely normal. They're not carriers. On the other hand, if you have a carrier woman crossed with a completely normal male, then the possibilities are different. That would say that half of the daughters will be completely normal. Half of them will be carriers, so no daughters will actually have the disorder, but half of them will carry it. Half of the males will be normal, and half of them will be affected. Will have the disorder. And of these three, like I said, these aren't all the possibilities, but of these three, the worst odds are when you have a carrier female and an affected male. Because then the only way you're going to get out completely normal is half of the sons, if any. The other half of the sons will be affected, half the daughters will be affected, and the other half of the daughters will be carriers. All right. Now to 7. While we're on the subject of sex-linked genes, we've already discussed the fact that in the XY system, which not only humans use, but cats as well, a female has two alleles for that gene, right? Because she has two X's. And a male has only one gene. That's why we called him a hemizygote, or a hemizygous individual. Well, this is a difference in so-called dosage, meaning that depending on sex, you'll get a different dose of the gene. You probably can't see white. And therefore, the two sexes aren't equal with respect to dosage. Well, some organisms make up for that in different ways, and that's called dosage compensation. What we have here is the situation that a female has a double dose. She has two alleles. A male has a single dose. If you think about this as a problem that you're trying to correct for, you could go about correcting it either of two ways, and they both happen depending on species. One way is to bring the male up to the level of the female somehow, which you could do by transcribing that single allele that he has twice as much as would normally be. Whereas it's just a normal amount of transcription in her, but she has two of them, so it makes them equal. You see what I'm saying there? The other way, though, would be to bring the female down to the level of the male. And that's what's happening in the example we're looking at in the slide. This happens in humans as well. Not with fur color. We don't have fur, but... Anyway, what's this kind of dosage compensation that we're looking at here is called X chromosome inactivation. And it does exactly what the name says. Inactivates one X chromosome in each cell. Now, this happens before birth, so not in a fully formed adult. But still, this cat before birth, right? When it's just some number of cells big, doesn't look like a cat yet, hasn't been born, each of those cells, of course, has two X chromosomes because this is a male embryo. How X chromosome inactivation works, though, is that one of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated, but it doesn't matter which one. It's just a flip of a coin, basically. Per cell, it's a random choice. Well, if this female is homozygous for whatever gene this is, in this case it's fur color, it wouldn't really matter, right? You randomly choose one X chromosome, but they both have the same allele if she's homozygous. So it wouldn't matter which one gets turned off, right? You're still going to have the same one turned on. But it does matter for a heterozygous female, which is what this cell indicates. She's heterozygous because her two X chromosomes carry different alleles for fur color. One of them has the orange allele and one of them has the black allele. So if you randomly choose one of those X chromosomes, you're going to either turn off orangeness or turn off blackness. It matters. Well, if this happened, this X chromosome inactivation happened at the zygote stage, that's one cell big, right? Then you would turn off either black and leave orange on, or turn off orange and leave black on. And that would be permanent because it would still be turned off when that divides into two. And then those would divide into four. They would all have the same chromosome inactivated. And therefore, depending on which one was chosen randomly at the zygote stage, the cat would be either fully orange or fully black. Do you see that? But that's not what happens. It doesn't happen at the zygote stage. It happens a little later. In the embryonic stage, an embryo is multicellular because the zygote has already gone through cell division. So it's some number of cells big. And each of those cells, however many there are in the embryo, rolls its or tosses its own coin as to which one gets inactivated. Okay, so you have a mass of cells, like my fist is a mass of cells. Each one's going to turn off either orange or black, and that's going to be permanent, meaning not only for that cell, but for all the cells that it gives rise to by dividing. And so, depending on where that cell is in the embryo, where its position is on the embryo, that will turn into cells that will occupy that portion of the body of the adult. And this is why you have a cat that is a patchwork of orange, randomly occurring orange patches and randomly occurring black patches, depending on the position of the cell when it was an embryo, turning black or turning orange. That's called X chromosome inactivation. And we call such a female a mosaic, which kind of is a patchwork pattern. Well, I said this can happen with humans as well, but not for fur color. An example for humans would be how the relative ability to sweat. So this isn't something you can look at a female and see like you can for a cat with fur color. But a heterozygous female in that case would have patches of skin that can freely sweat and others that can't. It's just so it's something you could measure, but you'd have to go in there and look at it pore by pore. Anyway, that's a mosaic. And X chromosome inactivation is just one example of epigenetics, or an epigenetic change. Epigenetics is a science that studies these kind of changes, but epigenetic means above the level of the gene. That's what the word linguistically means. But what an epigenetic change is a change in DNA, and therefore a change in the way it's expressed, without actually changing the sequence. Mutation would be a change in sequence, right? Epigenetics doesn't change anything about the sequence of DNA, but it changes how that DNA gets expressed or whether or not it gets expressed. X chromosome is just one example of that. And how it happens, by the way, when it does happen, is that the one X chromosome that gets chosen to be inactivated gets very tightly coiled up. Remember we talked about the coiling of chromatin and how it has to not be tightly coiled when you're using it to read the genes? Well, if you tightly coil it up and keep it tightly coiled up for the lifetime of the individual, the genes are all there, they just can't be accessed. So it's like locking the bookshelf in a sense. You can't get to any of those genes. So you have to use the genes that are on the other X chromosome only. And that brings her down to the level of the male because a male has only one X chromosome. So they each sex, therefore, has just one allele that's usable. All right, let's go to 8 and look at flies again. Here we have it's a dihybrid cross to start with, because we're paying attention to two different characteristics here, right? Body color, which can be either gray or black, and gray is dominant to black. B stands for black, but when you have the plus, it really means wild type, which is the gray. B by itself is black. That's one characteristic. Or wing shape, or wing size. The normal full wing is dominant, and that's VG plus, but the VG stands for the recessive trait, which is, or the recessive allele, which is the vestigial wing, which is very much reduced in size, as you see here. So this one, this parent, is doubly homozygous dominant, gray-bodied and full-winged. This one is doubly homozygous recessive, black-bodied and vestigial wing. If you cross those to make an F1, all the F1s, as you already predict from what we've covered already, will have the same phenotype because they'll all be double heterozygotes, right? Every one of them will be B plus B, VG plus VG. Does that make sense? And because of dominance, that means every one of the F1s are going to be dominant in both characteristics. They're going to have the dominant gray body color and the dominant full wing shape. Well, this is not like the other dihybrid crosses we're going to do, though, because we're not going to then cross F1s with other F1s to produce an F2. Instead, we're going to take an F1 and cross it with a doubly homozygous recessive individual in a special kind of test cross. And when you do that, the doubly homozygous recessive one that you're crossing it with, because it's homozygous, can only make one kind of sperm. This one happens to be the male. He can only make one kind of gamete, right? Because he's BB, VG, VG. You choose a B and you choose a VG, there's only one choice. That's why this Punnett square has one row. But in this case, the female, and this isn't sex length, they just happen to show the sexes. It wouldn't really matter. It could work either way. But the F1, which is what she is, she's heterozygous for both, and therefore there's four possibilities for her eggs, right? You can choose a B plus and a VG plus, a B plus and a VG, a B and a VG plus, or a B and a VG. Those are the four egg types. Therefore, the Punnett square says these are the possible types of zygotes. But look at these predicted ratios based on hypotheses. Remember, predictions come logically from hypotheses. In other words, if a hypothesis is true, you would predict such and such. The hypotheses here are different. They're different explanations. One hypothesis is that these two genes that we're looking at, body color and wing shape, are on different chromosomes. If they're on different chromosomes, then you would expect all four of these possibilities, and they would be equally likely, because it's totally random. Okay, flip the coin. And therefore, you'd expect the ratio, the phenotypic ratio, to be 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. 25%, 25%, 25%, 25% for all the possibilities. The other hypothesis is that the genes are not located on different chromosomes. They're on the same chromosome. And therefore, remember, I said that genes don't move around individually. They are passengers. Like passengers on a boat. The boat is the chromosome. Wherever the chromosome goes, all of those genes go. So if two genes, these two that we're looking at, are on the same chromosome, they would be traveling together, not separately. And therefore, if they are on the same chromosome, you would expect these two first ones pictures listed as being possible. Those are the parental types. Because each one of those is like one parent or the other. But you wouldn't expect any recombinant types. That shouldn't be possible because the genes travel together. And therefore the expected ratio would be 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. These zeros indicate that you shouldn't be able to see any of these. Well, notice that one of these hypotheses has to be true. Either the two genes are on the same chromosome or they aren't. There's no other possibility. So you would expect one of these predictions to come true. But look at the real results on the bottom line. Almost 1,000, almost 1,000, 200, 200. Neither of the predicted ratios came true, in other words. There were some recombinant types. Gray body and vestigial wing, not like either parent. Black body and full wing, not like either parent. Those are recombinant types. And so this second hypothesis seems to be violated because it's predicted zero. But if it's the first hypothesis, you should expect just as many of these recombinants as you have parentals. And when you have a sample size this big, a couple thousand almost, then it should be really close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. Well, the fact that there are so many fewer recombinants than parentals suggests that actually these two genes are on the same chromosome. And before I forget, let me tell you that there's a special word for that. Linked. Now, be careful with the word linked, because we've already been through sex-linked, and they are two totally different things. First of all, sex-linked is a phrase that you apply to a single gene. Any individual gene is either sex-linked or not, because all sex-linked means is that that gene is on a sex chromosome rather than being on an autosome. Okay, so it makes sense to talk about a single gene being sex-linked or not. Linked does not make any sense for one gene by itself. We use the word linked to describe two genes. And so a pair of genes can either be linked or not. Linked for a pair of genes means that those two genes are on the same chromosome. If they're not linked, then they're on different chromosomes. And those are the two hypotheses being tested here. Okay? So the real results suggest that they are linked, because otherwise you would get 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 pretty close. But if they're linked, you shouldn't get any of these, and you don't get many. What can explain this? How can you have two genes that are on the same chromosome but end up in different cells? And I really shouldn't be saying genes, I should say alleles, right? You have two alleles that are passengers on a chromosome. And they are therefore linked. How can they actually end up going to separate cells? How can they separate from each other if they're on the same chromosome? By what mechanism? Exactly. Crossing over explains how this can happen. Remember that crossing over involves a swapping of material between non-sister chromatids. One homolog will swap a section with the same section from the other homolog. And that's how they can end up going to separate cells. We see that result in 9 explained. Okay, so this is the same cross, but now we're looking at the chromosomes. When it comes to meiosis to produce the gametes from this F1 individual, this is not the original parent. This is the F1. She looks like the original parent, but she's heterozygous, not homozygous. All right, so these are her chromosomes, her X chromosomes. One of them has the dominant alleles for both body color and wing shape, and the other X chromosome has the two recessive alleles. Well, the dominant one makes her dominant, but she has both alleles because she's heterozygous. And notice the black slot marks on the chromosomes. Those are the loci, which is the plural of locus. Those are the positions of the two genes. So they're riding together. Notice if you didn't have crossing over, that means this B and the BG would always go together. And that's why you would expect no possibility of B plus and VG, because they're going to go to different cells, different gametes. But remember that in prophase 1, which is part of meiosis, gamete formation, crossing over can occur. And crossing over involves that chiasma, that crossover point, and that chiasma can form anywhere along the length of the chromosome. Well, if it happens, just randomly, that the chiasma forms between the two gene loci, between the two black marks, then when they swap, that's going to allow for this to happen. Notice that the VG that was on the fully red one gets put onto the formerly
completely pink one. And the B and the VG plus are now going to go to one gamete, and the B plus and VG are going to go to the other one. That's how recombinance can be possible. You following this? Okay, now, but think about this, the chances of that happening. Or think about crossing over occurring, but not between the two positions. If crossing over occurs anywhere out here, or anywhere here, in other words, anywhere except between the two black marks, then it's not going to separate the two, right? They're still going to travel together. The only way they can be separated from each other is if you form a crossover point, a chiasma, between the two positions. And two genes that are linked simply means they're on the same chromosome. Doesn't tell you at all where they are. Well, if two genes are very far apart from each other on that same chromosome, then the chances of a chiasma forming between them is much higher, right? The closer they are to each other on the same chromosome, the less and less likely it becomes for a chiasma to randomly form between those two close points. And therefore, we have what's on the bottom here. A grad student decades ago figured this out. This is way before we could look at DNA. And by looking at these actual results, computed what's called a recombination frequency. The recombination frequency is simply the total number of recombinant types that you get. This 391 is all of these plus all of these, the ones that are not like either parent, divided by the total number of offspring, all four of them added together, and then just multiplied by 100 to make it a percentage. In other words, the recombination frequency tells you what fraction of the total offspring are recombinant types. And if genes are not linked, if they're on separate chromosomes, you would expect that to be 50%. Because recombinant and parental types are equally possible in that case. But what this grad student figured out is that the lower the recombination frequency is the closer together those two genes must be on the same chromosome to account for that low likelihood. And this allowed him to mathematically, without ever looking at the DNA, which wasn't possible then, to mathematically make what's called a gene map. Figuring out what all the genes are is important, part of learning about an organism. But that doesn't at all tell you where they are. It's also valuable to know where the genes are. And so the first question is, which specific chromosome is such and such gene on? That's part of gene mapping. And then once you know that there's a collection of genes that, because of these test crosses, look like they are linked, they must be on the same chromosome, then the next question is, where are they on that chromosome? What is the order with respect to each other? And we can do this just mathematically without even looking at the DNA by looking at recombination frequencies. The lower they are, the closer the two genes are, the more linked they are, in other words. That's what's illustrated in 10. So in this case, there were three different crosses, like the ones we just looked at, that were done. One of them is using the color, the body color gene, that's the B one, and the wing shape, that's VG, that's the cross we just looked at. So that had a recombination frequency of 17%. Then they did body color and eye color, which is what the CN is an example of, and they saw 9% recombination frequency. Then eye color and wing shape they did, and that was a 9.5% frequency. So they said, well, these three must be arranged in this order because these frequencies are smaller. This one's bigger. You see that? And then they just do this takes a lot of work to do all these crosses if you're dealing with a lot of different chromosomes, I mean a lot of different genes, but it can allow you to map them, and that's what 11 shows you.
These numbers really are not, these are just relative numbers. Zero was set for this one that
they said this one must be toward the end, and then all these other numbers are relative distances from zero, but they're all obtained by recombination frequencies.
So that's a lot of work, but it's a pretty cool technique. Now, of course, we could just look at the DNA, so it's a lot easier. But that was a breakthrough. Okay, 12. In normal meiosis, meaning how we've studied already, normal meaning nothing's going wrong, everything happens without a hitch. But in normal meiosis, as you already know, there are two division events, right? Meiosis 1, meiosis 2. And in a division event, things separate from each other. What separates in meiosis 1 is different from what separates in meiosis 2, but it's still, in both of them, things are separating from each other. And another word for separation from each other is disjunction, to disjoin, which is the noun form, means to separate. So disjunction means separation, and that's what normally happens. Usually it happens right. But if something goes wrong and things don't disjoin, then that is non-disjunction. And that's what we're looking at here in this slide. And non-disjunction can occur either in meiosis 1 or meiosis 2. Because it's an error. It just randomly happens. Well, notice that if non-disjunction occurs, then the two cells, we're assuming that cytokinesis is also occurring, right? It's not just the nucleus. Then the two cells that result after the non-disjunction event are going to have different numbers of chromosomes. We talked about ploidy quite a bit already, right? I gave you the words ploidy, haploidy, diploidy. But another word that uses ploidy in it is euploidy. EU, like the same, this is the same prefix as in eukaryote, meaning true or good. So euploidy means having the correct number of chromosomes for whatever species it is. A euploid human cell has 23 or 46, depending on whether it's diploid or haploid, but that's normal. Okay, that's the normal situation. Anything other than the normal number of chromosomes, which would be euploid, is called aneuploidy. Putting an an just makes it not. And non-disjunction causes aneuploidy. Let's look at what's happening on the left here. You have non-disjunction on the left happening in meiosis 1. That's when the tetrads are lining up, right? Well, the first tetrad is splitting just fine. That's undergoing normality. But this second one, I really should say first, because it's the bigger one, so it should be number one. But anyway, this one is not disjoining. And notice that what that's going to mean is that one of these cells is going to get both homologs, the other one's not going to get either homolog. Both of those is wrong, right? Each cell is supposed to get one homolog. Neither cell gets one. One of them gets two, one of them gets zero. So both cells are aneuploid already, but for different reasons. Now, which of these two cells has a better chance of surviving? Yeah, the one on the left. Having too many chromosomes is problematic. That causes all kinds of problems. But it's still better than not having any chromosome, right? So keep in mind that this is a chromosome we're talking about. This is an example of a mutation at the chromosomal level. So this is a mutation kind. But this is affecting all of the genes that are carried by that chromosome, which can be thousands.
But already these two daughter cells are aneuploid.
Even if they undergo normal disjunction in meiosis II, since they're abnormal to begin with, all four of the gametes are going to be aneuploid. And these ones that don't, that have a missing chromosome, are very unlikely to allow for a zygote that will survive. On the right, we have non-disjunction occurring. Or meiosis I happens normally, but then when it comes to disjoining the chromatids in meiosis II, this one does not disjoin. That's still going to lead to aneuploidy, but only in this cell, and therefore only these two gametes will be aneuploid. This one will still give rise to two normal gametes. Okay, 13 is a listing of other kinds of chromosomal mutations. Most of the mutations we've talked about already in the course have been point mutations, remember. Though that involves one or a very small number of nucleotides. So it's not even an entire gene, but it's some small part of a gene. A chromosomal mutation involves huge chunks of chromosomes, and therefore many, many genes are involved. So it's a much large-scale effect. We're looking at chromosomes here with letters on them, but the letters are not genes. They're just sections of the chromosome. A, B, C, and D, so on. So A itself contains many genes. Just think of A as being a chunk of the chromosome, and so on. Well, the first possibility is deletion. Same word for a possibility of a point mutation. We talked about deletions and insertions. But instead of deleting or inserting a single nucleotide, a big chunk of the overall chromosome is deleted in this case. So A, B, C, D, E, and so on becomes A, B, C, E. The D is missing. And all of the genes that are in D are going to be gone. Well, that's going to be a big deal, right? If those are genes that code for proteins that are absolutely necessary, then that's going to be hard to survive. Duplication means that something is copied. So instead of having just one of them, you have two. So A, B, C, D, the B, C section gets duplicated. Now it becomes A, B, C, B, C again, and then D, E, F. That's more survivable because you still have all the genes, but now you have extra sets of some genes. As a matter of fact, this occurs, there's evidence of this occurring a lot because it's survivable. I mean, the other ones probably occur at the same frequency, it's just we don't have evidence of them because the people don't survive, or the, I shouldn't say people, it's not necessarily humans. But in our own DNA, there is evidence that this duplication mutation occurred a lot of times. Not only because it's survivable, that's why it gets passed on, but it also actually can be possibly beneficial, because what all the genes that are in this part that's duplicated still are there and can do their job, but now you have extra sets of them, and they're kind of like a laboratory, because those can undergo a mutation without actually any fear of causing anything bad, right? Because you still have your original ones. But if by chance they mutate into even better things, then it would be better to have those new versions. Inversion, to invert means to turn around. And so A, B, C, D, E becomes A, D, C, B, E. This version just got flipped. Well, notice there's no new material, and there's no material taken away or added. It's the same amount. But it can still cause some effects because, for a couple reasons. One is that the cut mark, where the arrows, the cut marks, those could have occurred right in the middle of genes, right? So that gene gets destroyed if you make a cut and then replace it with something else from another gene. That's one way it can happen. But even for genes that aren't cut, if they are now in a different position in the overall chromosome, then even though they are an intact gene, they might not be expressed the same way because these regions that I was talking about, these non-coding regions of DNA that occur between the genes, those can be involved in determining what are controlling when genes themselves get turned on or off, which is important. So the gene might still be there, but it might not be able to be turned on, which could be bad, or it might not be able to be turned off, which could also be bad. You're always making that protein, but you shouldn't always be making it. The most complex of these four possibilities is reciprocal translocation, because it involves two different chromosomes. So what's happening here is that a piece breaks off of one chromosome, AB here, and a piece breaks off of another chromosome, MNO here, and they end up being swapped. So MNO is now on the wrong chromosome, and AB is now on the wrong chromosome. Well, once again, this is going to affect how the genes that are in those sections get activated or deactivated. So it's not going to be a normal situation. And there's a specific example in humans of reciprocal translocation involving chromosomes 9 and 22. For whatever reason, chemically, it's not all that unlikely for it to happen. I forget one in however many, but it does happen fairly frequently. And when it does happen, that is one way to get leukemia. That's called the Philadelphia chromosome after the mutation has occurred, and it can lead to leukemia. Before, when we were looking at X chromosome inactivation, I told you that that's an example of an epigenetic change, because it's not the DNA sequence that changes, but it's something about the overall chromosomal structure gets changed so that the genes themselves get expressed differently or not at all. Well, here we're looking at another epigenetic example. In 15, the example is imprinting, genetic imprinting, as it's called. What happens in genetic imprinting is that one of the two alleles for a gene gets turned off for the entire lifetime of the offspring, but it's not actually random. Like X chromosome inactivation is a random toss of a coin, more or less. For genetic imprinting, the allele that gets turned off in the offspring is determined by whether it came from the mother or the father. Not all genes work this way, but we're discovering more and more. And some of them get turned off if they came from the mother. Other genes are just the opposite. They'll get turned off if they came from the father. So let's look at a homozygote. A homozygote has two different alleles, right? The IGF gene, IGF2, sorry. There's one of them is normal, and one of them... Oh, this is a homozygous, so they have both of them that are the same. They're both the normal gene, normal allele. But one of them gets... The one that came from the father is the only one that gets expressed. The mother's one gets turned off, just like kind of like X chromosome inactivation, but it's for a different reason. Still, though, the you're leaving on a normal one, and therefore the mouse is normal size. There's two possibilities for heterozygous individuals, though. And just for genetic reasons, you would expect heterozygous individuals to be the same, right, in phenotype. But because this is an epigenetic phenomenon, they are not. This heterozygous individual got the normal allele for body size from the father. That's the one that gets stayed on. And the mutant one from the mother, well, that gets turned off. So this mouse is going to be normal size because the one that got stayed on was normal. But the other kind of heterozygous, just the reverse of this, got the father gave him the dwarf size, the dwarf version, that's the one that stays on. The mother's normal allele gets turned off because the whole chromosome, just the gene does. And therefore the mouse is dwarf size. They're both heterozygous, but they have radically different phenotypes because of this epigenetic phenomenon. And there's other epigenetic changes as well, but that's, I just wanted to introduce you to the word epigenetic. That means you now know everything there is to know about cellular biology. And there's only two things left to do, other than any Connect homework. That I don't know whether any, is there still any due? Okay, so there's that, it's due tonight. There's that, of course there's the final exam, which, let me remind you, is only Unit 5. It's not comprehensive. Let's see. We start at 10, so yes, it's the normal time. It's on, is it Wednesday, right? Wednesday at 10, so don't forget Scantron for that. Also, let me remind you that the option to retake on the Hoffman site expires tomorrow, so if you're interested in that, you could have to do it today or tomorrow. And the only other thing besides that is the practicum, which you're about to do. So I'll talk a little bit about that when we get there, but unlike normal lab days, I'm not going to open the door until right at 11:30. Therefore, at 11:28 or so, be right outside the door from when I open it. And then I'll say some more then.